Hey, friends, thanks for tuning into the Book Spider Podcast, a Book of the Week style program in which hosts Chris Malmberg, Hans Berger, and myself, Patrick Barney, attempt to sound as intelligent as possible while glossing over our gross misunderstandings of different texts. This episode, we're discussing Jean Toomer's Cain, a hybrid work of poetry and prose that weird critics sometimes call a novel. Rather than summarize the plot, which isn't exactly possible with Cain, I'm going to highlight some of the main features of the text. First and foremost, it seems to be an ode to the South, or at least the state of Georgia, where most of the action takes place. However, this ode is not without its criticisms, as depictions of racism, both petty and violent, arise in numerous passages. The basic structure of Cain is like a carousel that alternately shows the reader a short story, then a poem, then a short story again, though this isn't a rigid structure. Sometimes you get, you know, like two poems in a row or two short stories in a row, and the final piece is a novella of around 76 pages, so there's, you know, it breaks up a little bit. Overall, the poems tend to be deeply imagistic, usually describing some sight or phenomenon that you could see in Georgia. The short stories typically introduce one character, which is often a woman, or a pair of characters, and around these characters, the narration tends to revolve. Now and again, an I narrator appears to offer comments and insights, and the narrator gives clues that reveal that many of the stories happen in and around Sparta, Georgia. I would say the overall effect of Cain is an impressionistic reflection on the lives of black and mixed people who make their home in the South. So I mentioned to you guys I had a lot of questions about this one. I don't think we'll get to all of them because they're, you know, we just probably won't have time. But the one question that I wanted to start with, just so I could kind of gauge where, you know, you guys are at in relation to this, like what your headspace is in relation to this collection, and, you know, what you're most interested in, I thought we would just kind of talk about our favorite piece from Cain, and we could say why it's our favorite, just to, like, break the ice, so to speak. Anybody want to start, or should I start?
Yeah, I feel like I have this urge to go first just in case everybody has the same answer so that I don't have to, you know. The Becky vignette I thought was very poignant. I think a lot of this is I don't want to call it an obscure work precisely, but it's not necessarily, it's not really like, obviously it's not very plot driven, right? And it's right. Something that, you know, you come away from this, I think, with much more the memory of a series of kind of textures and feelings. And you come away with a lot of strong but vague memories, if that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. And the Becky vignette, which is of a white woman who has two sons who are both black and is kind of shunned by the community and lives in this house by the railway, which, you know, she's eventually killed, if I understood correctly, when her chimney collapses because of vibrations from the railway. There was just a little bit more of a sense of emotional directness there than a lot of the rest of the novel. Not the novel, but the book, you know. And that kind of, some of the details and the character in that, it had a way of sticking that some of the rest of the piece, or the series of pieces, didn't. And I don't even mean it in a bad way that they didn't stick, right? It just, I think to a great extent, it kind of is more about that sense of texture than about some of the kind of conventional elements, like, you know, like plot, or, I mean, most of the characters, there are characters, but the characters don't really quite, for the most part, don't really have arcs, or, you know,
right.
So when I say that I don't mean it as a criticism to say that this stuck in a little more conventional way. It's just a question of the kind of effect of the form.
Yeah. I think I'm glad you mentioned Becky, because that's a story that I definitely want to talk about, because I actually think it's kind of a key to understanding the whole collection. As I told you guys, I read an afterword by Henry Louis Gates Jr., the African American critic. And he wrote it with somebody else, I'm not sure, Richard B. Haynes, or I forget what the other guy's name is, but it was a super interesting afterword that really helped me think about this. So when we get to Becky, maybe that'll be the best time to kind of reveal what I think Becky tells us about the whole collection. Chris, did you have a favorite one?
Yeah, and my reasons were similar to Hans's. Blood Burning Moon.
Sure.
It too had more of an arc with characters and conflict and a resolution to that conflict. Blood Burning Moon is about Louisa, who I think is mixed. Most of the women, at least in part one, it seems like women, mixed race women, are pretty much in throughout the whole book. At least I think they might be in every time there is like a romantic interest in section one. At least it seems like it's a mixed race woman.
Yeah,
and she is
like a lot of the characters are not actually, you know, quote unquote black. You know, I know that. Like they're mixed, actually. A lot of the characters are.
Yeah, and I think,
quote unquote.
Yeah, and I think that the well, anyway, she is seeing romantically both a white man and a black man, and she's in the middle of meeting with the black man when the white man interrupts, and they get into a scuffle. The white man is killed, and then the black man is burned to death. And it's a very simple, I think, like, one of the things about it is that I kind of appreciated the simplicity of it. And then the final scene really pushes beyond kind of the end, the physical ending of this black man and the like distraught state that it leaves Louisa, the woman at the center of the love triangle. It just ends really like big and lyrical and mythical. And despite being pretty simple, I think it actually is very effective. So I liked Blood Burning Moon.
Yeah. Yeah, Blood Burning Moon is actually my favorite story as well. But just to do something different, my second favorite piece is Conversion, a poem. And it seems to describe the transformation of an African god into an acolyte of the Christian god. And you know, it's very strange. Maybe the African god becomes like infatuated with the Christian god because he's drunk, or maybe because he's poisoned. But I'm definitely interested in how the idea of conversion relates to the rest of the collection. So I think we have three like representative pieces that we're talking about: Becky, Blood Burning Moon, and Conversion. And I think that, you know, Becky is a good kind of representative piece, because it seems to be about how Becky occupies an in between space. Like she's ostracized from her community for having mixed race children, and she ends up living between two train tracks on the edge of town. So that seems to bring up the idea of liminal spaces in Kane. Blood Burning Moon, you know, has this big simplicity, as you said, Chris. So I definitely think that it is also representative of liminality in a different way. Is liminality a word? I'm not sure.
I get what you're saying.
Right. I definitely think that these are three good pieces to discuss. So does that make sense? The idea of being in between two places. Would you agree that this is a motif in the work?
Yeah, it seems with the focus of many of these pieces, not just in the first section. I'm thinking, is it Avi? How you pronounce that? Too? It might have been that story. Someone is described. It might have been Louisa, but one of the women, and it is very common for the women in this book to be mixed race, is described as having skin like autumn leaves. There is a kind of an attention to the like physical sort of like manifestations of, you know, having a, you know, one black parent and one white parent, or at least mixed heritage. And that being something that really establishes some of these characters in between, where they don't feel like they belong or are not allowed to belong.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Either like black communities
Esther
or white communities.
Esther is described as having like milky skin. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think is that kind of what you're getting at when you talk about liminality?
Yeah, culture? Exactly.
Presumably, I mean, maybe this is so much of an obvious point that it you know, is kind of underwhelming to even make, right? But like the form, the mixed genre form of the work is another point of liminality / blending, etc., right? And I mean, that's not really an interesting point in itself, but as long as we're laying out the kind of basic uses of that motif here, you know, we can have that on the table as something to think about at more length.
Like the structure. I definitely think there's an excellent like unification of content and structure here when we're trying to, you know, describe what it's like to live in the in-between space of being mixed or passing as white. You know, we have women who are mixed. We have, you know, love triangles involving a black man and a white man over a mixed woman. And then we have the mixed structure of poetry and prose. And then later on in Cabness, the final piece, we have liminality in content and form as well. Cabness is a mixed man from the north who comes to the south to teach. So there's him being mixed, and then there's the fact that the dialogue is all in like play format. I don't know if that does anything, like the play format dialogue in that novella. I don't know if it does anything more than contribute to the in-between space or the liminality, but it's definitely there. So it like kind of keeps coming back over and over again. And so as I said, I mentioned that I read this afterword, which was pretty good. Like a big portion of the afterword was like an autobiography of Gene Toomer. And so Gates's argument is that there's so much about mixed people and in between places in the collection, because what the collection is most interested in discussing is the idea of being neither black nor white, of not fitting in either with black culture or with white culture, and both sides not seeing you as part of a culture that you at least have some ancestry in. So that was his kind of main argument. And what he uses a lot of Gene Toomer's autobiography, because Gene Toomer was mixed himself. His maternal, on the maternal grandparents' side, his maternal grandmother was mixed. His maternal grandfather was also mixed, but was very close to passing as white very often. Then on his father's side, his father was mixed, his mother was mixed, and he had experiences when he grew up as both living in black communities, and oftentimes he passed for white. So I think his first couple of years of college, he you know, wrote white on his census bureau or something, you know, a census document. And so there's absolutely this idea of, you know, the content and structure of this being about being mixed and not having a stable racial identity, to the point that Toomer wanted to call himself American as opposed to black or white. Like he would tell people, I'm neither black nor white. I'm American. So I think there's a lot of that in here.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, I think, as a way of understanding the what you've already mentioned, right? That repeating motif of in between spaces and the genre hybridity, and the way that characters who are kind of I guess indeterminate race appear so much in here. So yeah, that structurally that does make a lot of sense. And that, yeah. I mean, I know that we kind of, you know, the whole question of how much the author's intention or life determines the meaning of the work is very kind of fought over, right? But if you think of those as relevant things to bring in, it's very, very hard not to see a huge amount of that reflected here.
Right, right. And I'm, however, there are still some things that I don't know exactly why. Like, if we accept that at face value, if we accept that the book is about representing hybridity, being in between, not having, you know, a stable identity one way or the other, if we accept that the text is about this, there are still some things in the text that pose questions to us. So, for example, you mentioned, Hans, that you come away from this more with like a sense of emotion and like vague feelings as opposed to any like comprehensive understanding of a plot or whatnot. So
texture. I used the word texture and that's right. Very a key word for my sense of the book, but go ahead.
Yeah, texture is good. So why do we have this kind of like the whole effect of the work is like a texture poem. So why do we have this? Why are we concerned with dreaminess of tone and imagery, assuming that we could still capture the whole idea of liminality with or without the dreaminess? So why do we opt for dreaminess as opposed to like narrative coherence or whatnot?
Patrick, you say when you say why do we opt for dreaminess, you mean why is dreaminess the chosen technique here as opposed to a more conventional structure? Okay, yeah, just right, making sure I understood the question.
I mean, like, why does the book do this?
Sure.
As opposed, like, obviously, we're not doing it. I talk to my students that way all the time when I'm trying to help them with papers. I'm like, this is what we need to do. So, and sorry about that.
I was just going to double down on the question, maybe just, like, thinking about it, because it is something that occurred to me. It feels as though the conflicts here can be and are like in the story that we both like, Blood Burning Moon. Thank you. Blood Burning Moon. They can be very, like, the action can be very concrete, and the things that can happen that explore these themes can be very like can be explored through plot and isolated in that way. So I too kind of have that. I don't know if I have an answer, but it seems as though it is very intentional, because it's not as though, you know, like, it's not as though there are a ton of very clear, easy to tell clear stories about, you know, what it means to be a mixed race person caught between caught in the conflicts between, you know, white and black racial communities, you know, in a particular part of Georgia. Like, it feels like that could be very, very simple, and it's not told that way.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose to some extent it's partly, you know, when you have a story that comes to a fixed conclusion, and I guess there are some fixed conclusions here, right? I mean, the chimney falls and kills Becky, the two men die in Blood Burning Moon, right? But the more maybe that you commit to fixed conclusions in a narrative, the more you're kind of defining possibility within the world that you're trying to represent, right? The more you're circumscribing possibility within the world that you're trying to represent. And this feels like a book that is, it feels like a book that does not want to circumscribe possibility, right? And so the relative kind of lack of narrative coherence and closure to some extent might partly be kind of a thematic commitment to, it might be a structural expression of a thematic commitment to openness and possibility, in the same way that so much of the kind of, you know, genre hybridity is a kind of commitment to openness and possibility, right? It reminds me a bit, actually, the line of critique that we're making here reminds me a bit of what we said last week about Wayward by Dana Spiotta, right? The argument we had about Wayward was, and argument is too strong a word maybe, but the discussion we had about Wayward was whether or not it is a weakness of that novel that the various plot threads tend to kind of resolve in anticlimax, and the because and essentially like the one of the conclusions that we kind of grasped toward was the idea that that it would in fact be, you know, to allow those plots to burst into conventional climax would ultimately be counterproductive to the point Spiot is trying to make about the events under consideration. And I wonder if maybe I'm trying to make a similar point here with Kane, right? That like the too much focus on conventional plot resolution kind of narrows the possibilities and boundaries of something that in many ways is about existing in a more boundaryless space. The thought's
that
not
makes
very
a
well
lot of
developed,
sense to me.
Unfortunately. Good.
That makes a lot of sense to me because it is clear to me that despite the like violence in the like the violence that's depicted and the incidents of racism that are depicted, it's clear to me that the book is optimistic to me. Like I feel like this book is one that is like, I don't think it's overly optimistic, but I think it is ultimately optimistic and hopeful about the liminality that it's discussing and describing. And so if we don't want to circumscribe possibility, as you said, Hans, then because we want being mixed, or as Toomer would put it, being an American to be a hopeful thing, we want to leave that open, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, to, you know, if there were a larger plot here, or if there were many plots that definitively resolved, if the general direction of the like plot resolution was toward tragedy, then that makes a statement about the inevitable. It makes a pessimistic statement about the nature of race in America. And if the general thrust of the plot resolution is toward happiness, then that maybe makes too positive a statement on a what, you know, was not a topic that you could really be too optimistic about at that point in history with any sense. And I don't know that there's, you know, to write something that is, it's almost like to write something that is authentic and compelling in its emotional relationship to race in America, you have to leave some ambiguity and yeah, a lack of plot-based resolution for the most part is one way of kind of gesturing toward that ambiguity, which is the most reasonable form of optimism.
Right. Yeah. That seems like a good connection with another question I have, is whether we ultimately think that this collection is hopeful or despairing. I first read this book in grad school, and a fellow classmate really liked this Kane too, and both of us ended up writing our final papers for the class about it. And I was in my existential phase at the time, so I wanted to talk about like spiritual exile in the characters, which is fine and dandy. Like there, I think we probably could see characters that are in, you know, spiritual exile, but my classmate was more critical. He liked Kane, but I also think he thought it was a failing that he believed that the collection just cycles through hope and despair, like back and forth, round and around, with despair ultimately winning. And he, while he liked the collection, I don't think he liked that aspect of it. And I wonder if, do we agree with that or no?
I mean, I'm looking through the list of, I'm looking through the list of sections, and I'm having trouble finding much, I'm having trouble finding many pieces which can be, at a glance, can be read in a particularly optimistic way. I mean, I think that his point, his basic point that the motif of cycles of hope and despair, there certainly is a motif of a cycle of hope poisoned by despair here. I don't think that's at all an unfair. I think if you're going to draw a, if you're going to draw a convincing reading of this as actually being optimistic or hopeful, you would have to do that by first acknowledging the presence of that cycle of hope and despair, and then seeing, and then trying to kind of look below that or make some more advanced reading from that fairly obvious and compelling appraisal. I think that that would be entirely possible. I don't know that I have the, I don't know that I have enough understanding of the work to do it myself right now. But I also think that I want there to be a more textured reading than that. You know, I want you to, I want it, I want to agree with you.
Let me, hold on a second. Let me pull
up. Let me just call him.
No, no, I can't. Unfortunately, I can't call my classmate. I could email. Actually, like, I don't have his email anymore. He's not on Facebook, so. What I just want to, what I want to do is pull up a PDF of the work. So I want to, like, look at some of the poems. I felt like there's another like thing that another element that we haven't talked about, which is that some of the lyric quality of this work absolutely has to do with representation of Negro spirituals and. Like, you know, I know Negro is no longer a PC term, but that's definitely like the name that is given to this, the songs and whatnot sung by slaves and other, black field workers, you know, to like keep their spirits up. And I'm wondering if there are any of the poems that, that might seem no like yeah it's like I'm looking at the poems and they're typically downers too, like they're awesome, I love them, like so the poem Face, hair silver gray like streams of stars, brows recurved canoes quivered by the ripples blown by pain. Her eyes, mists of tears condensing on the flesh below, and her channeled muscles are cluster grapes of sorrow, purple in the evening sun, nearly ripe for worms. Like, I love that. Her channeled muscles are cluster grapes of sorrow, purple in the evening sun. Like that is romantic, has a romantic quality, but then we end with nearly ripe for worms, you know? But maybe... maybe like maybe it's that romantic quality I'm reading as optimistic. Like I feel like to be a true maybe if you're seeing something that is sad but you are depicting it in a romantic way, I feel like there's a type of optimism in that.
Sure.
Insofar as you are trying to truly describe the human, the thing that you see as human or the thing that feels beautiful to you. Does that make sense?
I was about to ask, actually, does the presence of beauty necessarily, is acknowledging the presence of beauty necessarily an act of hope? Because there's,
right.
I mean, the kind of, again, the texture of this novel is so suffused with beauty and lyricism, and is the mere existence of beauty and lyricism, is that in fact hopeful and optimistic? I don't know.
Right.
I mean, you know, you can, you know.
I'm going to say it is.
Okay. Chris, you were going to say something.
Like, that just makes me, that reminds me of one of the things that I love about, it's a completely different work, but Moby Dick, like, basically Moby Dick is obsessed with doom, but that doom is beautiful. Like, it's a gorgeous, like,
yeah.
doom. And I don't know if is that kind of what you're talking about, Patrick, here?
Yeah. I doubt, like, recognizing something's beautiful in the midst of doom is hopeful, is optimistic, is one thing I'm saying. And I'm also agreeing with Hans that the mere act of, like, recognizing something beautiful or lyrical is optimistic.
It's probably not hopeful or optimistic in the sense that a lot of readers would find most relevant, right? Because because it's not about the political context, right? I mean, most people who read this now, like, the fact of choosing to read this novel is in itself a political act, right?
Sure.
And so most people who read this, if you're reading it in terms of optimism or despair, the question will be, can the role of African Americans in society be bettered? And from that standpoint, I'm not sure that there's any particular, you know, if you want to, from a rational linear standpoint, read it as a description of a social and political context, I don't think there's any room for optimism there. But I also don't think that it's necessarily, it's not a documentary, right? It's not journalism. And I think that, like, some people, probably most people who would read it might have the instinct to approach it that way. But it's not.
It seems like a lot of work. And I don't know how to really understand Cabness, but it seems like Cabness is where a lot of, like, the work Toomer would be doing to kind of set a trajectory, like a kind of either, if there is a kind of hopeful trajectory, which it does end very, very much at the very end, because most of it, I don't think, has at least... in my first reading, very much in it that is hopeful. It has a lot of beautiful language and some, I think, kind sentiment that maybe is not too present in the rest of the novel. I think Lewis is a little bit interesting in that I think that he seems to have a kind of empathy in him that is sort of a little bit of brightness, but it ends on the image of what is the line, light streaks through the iron-barred cellar window, within its soft circle the figures of Carrie and Father John, a kind of I don't know, something there, apart from that, I don't know exactly how to kind of, like, unpack Cabness to kind of pick out a theme that would be pushing me in the direction, Hans, you're talking about, like the situation is changing for these people, is getting better. It just seems as though, like, there's a little glimmer of something beautiful. I guess it is just a little glimmer of something beautiful in the midst of a pretty oppressive situation.
Yeah. I don't know.
I'm terrified of unpacking Cabness, by the way. Like, it kind of, it felt like, and I'm definitely speaking out of my ass here, but like it felt Beckett-y, you know, like somebody putting on a robe and everyone, you know, kind of like making fun of him, and like I didn't really know what's going on, and I think that like, yeah, it just it felt like a play, and it felt like it had like symbolic meaning that I didn't understand. So I'm a little terrified of Cabanis.
Mm. No, I agree. Like Cabanis, I would not say that Cabanis is one that I fully understand. You know, like I know what happens. Like Cabanis is a mixed guy from the north. He comes down for a job to Georgia. He kind of out of nowhere decides to be a drunkard and gets fired, and then he falls in with some, you know, people he befriends, and they kind of like lay about, you know, drinking and talking, and that's what happens, right?
And fucking, right?
Is she just, yeah.
Like, I mean, like they're all just kind of in a room together,
right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about. I'm not sure what the symbolism of Cabanis is. Part of me wonders if Cabanis is the narrator that pops up every now and then, just because the narrator that pops up every now and then points out that he's from the north. Like what would that mean if Cabanis is the narrator? Would that change anything? Like, would that shed any light on Cabanis itself, the novella or the story?
Well, I guess it would be a little bit of a hopeful resolution, to the extent that it would. I mean, Cabanis is kind of this, you know, aimless, inattentive, as you said, Chris Beckettian figure. And if he kind of becomes this collector of images and stories and tales and folk, it suggests that, you know, he eventually kind of reengages with the world in a productive way. I think that would be optimistic, again, not really in a bounded kind of political way, but optimistic in just kind of its orientation toward the world in a very more abstract way.
Yeah, I want to say, like, he's obviously very intelligent, and I feel like there's work here being, I want to say that there's work here being done to kind of like connect that intelligence to a kind of a sense of hopelessness and aimlessness and a lack of, I don't know if something is expected of Cabanis. I don't know if I understand that. Or if there's something that he could be doing that he isn't, but Hans, I can understand like your reading of that, like, there's maybe some application of his like ability with words and storytelling to do something. And maybe that's the rest of the stories.
I don't know if that creates a radical change in how we think of the work, but it's an interesting detail.
So we've already, you know, kind of moving on from Cabanis a little bit. I'm not sure that any of us really knows. Like, there are some ideas floating around here, and I think they're good ones, but like I think ultimately none of us is sure. So let's revisit like the texture and tone for a second. And I'm wondering specifically about one image that gets repeated over and over. There's actually two that get repeated a lot, Dusk and Cain. but Dusk feels more like, given that we've already talked about liminality, Dusk makes a lot of sense to me, given that it's, you know, it's between daytime and nighttime. But what about Cain? There are images of sugar cane, like all throughout the collection. You know, there's people chewing on cane. There's people, you know, eating sugar cane syrup. There are fields of cane. So is this just to like capture the scent of place, or does the image of Cain do anything else? I mean, it's the name of the collection, so I'm just wondering.
It makes me think of Dune, you know, and for me it is like the sense of place. Like, it is something where there is this way in which of this particular environment or ecology, even like if you could say like an ecology and environment confuse the sociology of a space, like all of it seems woven together, and Cain is this, you know, it is, if this were like a science fiction story like Dune, Cain would be the name and characteristic of the planet on which the story was told. It's like a, it takes place in a world that is infused with cane fields. And that's what I took from it.
Now, I think that's interesting. So when we think of Dune, the barrenness and harshness of the landscape in Dune, just as a metaphor, is really good for, you know, maybe representing House Harkonnen. But then, you know, when the Fremen are revealed later, well, the Fremen are known from the beginning, but later in the novel, we learn more about the Fremen. Their ability to survive and their hardiness maybe is representative of House Atreides. So that makes a lot of sense to me. So what, like, particular aspect of Cain if we're using a comparison to Dune, does Cain have particular attributes, sugar cane, have particular attributes that seem representative of other things in the collection? Or is it just the fact that there's so much cane? You know, there's a ton of fucking cane here.
There's just a ton of fucking cane. I really don't know. Like, there is
it's
one
dormant.
Piece.
Sorry, go ahead, Chris. There is one piece.
There is one piece that is explicitly about 7th Street. It does feel like, but I don't know if I could connect. I'm just looking at 7th Street right now, kind of on a flyer. I don't know if I can connect. It feels like I should, if I'm going to say that this is that they're saying. I feel like Cain and a sense of space is present, but I don't know if I can connect that, you know, to any of the themes of the novel.
Right. You have anything to offer on that front, Hansward?
Well, I mean, Cain, it's dormant sweetness, right? It's like sweetness in an unprocessed form.
Right.
So it's a raw material that could be turned into something sweet with the right coaxing. But perhaps, I don't know, maybe the pure sweetness is actually unappealing. Maybe there's some more some kind of more appealing quality it has in an unprocessed form. That's all I got. I got absolutely nowhere to go with that. All I have is like that first rung on the ladder.
Well, another thing that Gates said in his afterword was that one thing that Kane does that is super successful is use the experience of black and mixed peasants and working, like, I, you know, peasants and working class, like, you know, they're kind of two distinct classes. You know, if we're getting deep into Marxism, you know, they're two distinct classes, given that peasants own land. But regardless, so like, Toomer is using peasant and working class, black and mixed people as a metaphor for the American experience, is what Gates argues. And I wonder if, like, that meta, that idea that you just had, Hans, that it's unprocessed sweetness, like, we could do more with this. Maybe that's evidence that Gates is right, that the experience of these people is a metaphor for America or the American experience. Do you guys see the connection there, or am I just making shit up?
That does me. I don't know if you're just making shit up. I mean, if you're making shit up, you're making compelling shit up.
Oh,
I just
good.
I just don't have any other shit to, you know, throw in the shitter with it.
Well, I mean, either way, I think the, like, the image, the idea of unprocessed sweetness does make sense to me in that, like, we've got a bunch of peasant and working class people who are at the core of the depictions of this collection, and like the idea of unprocessed sweetness to me thinks that if we could process this, like, there's a lot of power, there's a lot to offer, there's, like, you know, artistic sentiment, there's leadership, there's beauty, there's all this kind of stuff in this class of people who are otherwise in, you know, dire straits.
What you're talking about reminds me of my other, I don't know if it'd be my other favorite story. It's the other one that sticks out in my head, Box Seat, in which Dan, who I think is a, I'm pretty sure is a black man, but he is, it follows him as he kind of sort of forcefully proposes to a woman that he's interested in. When she kind of turns him down, he follows her to this really kind of bizarre scene where little people are fighting each other, and a bunch of, you know, there's several people watching, and there are race is a part of it, but it does feel more like a class issue for why Muriel, the woman that he's sort of pursuing, is not going to marry him. And a lot of the box seat is filled with Dan's internal monologue, which is just full of rage. Like, it's just massively rageful, and it's a rage that feels less, it's not basically colored inside the lines of a simple sort of like racial, like being oppressed racially and wanting to, you know, fight back against that. It's more complex than that. And it is, I think, reflective of a more nuanced sort of like class oppression. That story ends with him kind of disengaging in a way that I thought this when we were talking about hope. It's not necessarily hopeful, but it is like basically Dan starts a fight or is kind of like goading a fight, and then the fight goes outside and he just sort of walks away. And it felt not necessarily hopeful, but it felt like a healthy sort of trajectory for someone who's filled with so much rage to just sort of like walk away. That felt to me like when you talk about class in this, that's the story that comes to mind.
Right. Yeah, no. I absolutely think that is a good, a representative story. I'm still not sure exactly how it all washes out, but definitely lots of interesting things to think about. One last question before we ask Chris what's next. And Hans, earlier you said that this isn't journalism. We can think about the socioeconomic political context of this book, but it's not journalism, and it doesn't seem to be concerned with politics in the way that some like really political novels are. And I was wondering though, like, that seems like markedly different from another novel that we have read for this podcast that deals with that black experience, and that's Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. And I was wondering if there was more to say about like how Invisible Man treats political issues versus how Kane does it.
Well, Invisible Man is so surreal and so kind of grotesque and exaggerated, right? And I think that a lot of the points I think that Invisible Man makes, it does through comic exaggeration and grotesquery. And, you know, I think that with Invisible Man, like that tonal quality and that kind of maybe thematic idea, that thematic direction are very closely tied together. And I think Kane is so much more, in spite of these kinds of bursts of, you know, violence and passion and ugliness, in many ways it is kind of a calmer, quieter, more meditative text. And I think the kind of the difference in kind of tone and mood and realism versus unrealism are, you know, is kind of, I don't know like which came first, right? But like the difference, I think, in the difference in thematic purpose seems very tied to the difference in mood. I guess they do both have pit fighting scenes, right? Like you mentioned, Chris, the what Wikipedia refers to as a dwarf fight. And, you know, there's a scene early in Invisible Man where the protagonist is paid to fight another man. So, you know, there's some overlap there, I think, in terms of images that they use to kind of suggest some of the degradation and grotesquerie of the lives of African-American characters in a particular time and place. But there's kind of a, there's an urgency and an intensity and an exaggeratedness to Invisible Man that I think is not at all present in, that is not at all present in Kane for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah. Good kind of overview of their differences. That's really enlightening. So cool. Yeah. Thanks for talking about this book with me. Like, this is the second time I've read it, and I actually, going into this, I didn't realize how many questions that I still had about the book, and like how much there is to discuss about it, even though it's so short. So yeah, thanks for like things you guys said really like kind of jived with me in my head. So Chris, it's your pick. What is up next?
The Complete Works of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Okay.
Excellent. I'm joking.
All right. I'll look forward to digging.
I thought you were digging. Sure, like.
No. No, that was a joke. So I cannot locate the book that I wanted us to read. I know its title, but I don't know how it's spelled. And it's been almost 16 years since I've read it. It's called Alternatives. And I'm not choosing it, but if our listeners know who wrote Alternatives, and it's spelled weirdly because it's a play. It was very locally published, I think, maybe even just in the Pacific Northwest, and did not have a huge run. And I've done some digging around. I can't find it. Alternatives. It is a story about kind of a group of people meeting, and one of them, kind of the main character, is someone who's Native American who's dating a white woman who's a cultural anthropologist, and he's hiding the fact that she basically made her PhD on a bunch of bullshit that him and his Native American friends made up, and that she published as like Native American stories in her studies, and kind of got actually kind of famous for it. And it's great. And I cannot, I don't have the book anymore, and I can't, I remember it as great.
Alternatives, play by author Drew Hayden Taylor.
Oh, you found it.
Yeah. And it's spelled like you would think, except that alter is in all lowercase. Natives is in all uppercase, and there is no space. A very liberal contemporary couple, Angel, an urban native science fiction writer, and Colleen, a non-practicing Jewish intellectual who teaches native literature, hosts a dinner party. The guests at this little sitcom soiree are couples that represent what by now have become the cliched extremes of both societies. Does that sound
right? That's it. Thank you. Yeah. You did so good. I tried so many different ways. I remembered one of them being in... I remembered it being spelled a little bit weird. I thought that it was like parentheses around alter or parentheses around natives. And so I was trying to
Googled alternatives play, spelling alternatives as two words. That's all.
Well,
I
see,
did.
when I did that, weirdly, I got a search result with Guar.
Guar, the
yeah, Guar. No shit.
The weird metal band.
You did that in like 20 seconds, and I mean, I didn't do it. I didn't spend hours doing this. I spent like 10 minutes trying. This wasn't
that's
like
crazy.
Some like momentous effort, but I was like, after 10 minutes of Googling, that's how fucking spoiled I am by Google.
We just
I was like,
must have
it's impossible.
Better Google here in Cincinnati than up
you
near
must
Bangor.
Have better. I would love to read this again. I think it definitely fits in just basically the use of storytelling and to kind of like get at an understanding of a people and a particular place and time. And in this case, I've kind of given away the turn, but it's not really actually like a, it's not really a secret. in the novel, in the play, if I remember right. But do you think you guys can get a hold of it?
Looks like there are copies on Amazon.
Expensive. Oh, used copies not too expensive.
Used copies copy $30. New copies $31.50 is what I see.
I see used copies for $4.
The only thing I would say is, like, if there's some possibility that we might want to be prepared to, I mean, this looks like a fast read if it's a play, but, you know, if we're ordering it through used Amazon sellers, through third-party Amazon sellers, we might want to be ready for it to take a week and a half for it to get here, and either be ready to read it in 3 days or be ready to, like, switch mine and Chris's maybe in the order. Or just push back the recording date. Just some awareness of that possibility.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm fine with any of that.
Okay. So why don't we say we're gonna do alternatives, and you know, we'll all try to get our copies, and you know, if we have to push the date back a week, or if you know, you two want to switch, that's totally cool. So, is that
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay. Yeah. All right, listeners, you have listened to our discussion of Gene Toomer's Kane, a hybrid work that probably has a lot to do with what Toomer termed the American race, you know, a race of like a collection of people who are mixed ethnicities, and like how that causes kind of this feeling of being in between. So I hope you've enjoyed it and found it enlightening. Peace out until our next discussion.